With me now on Fresh Air is James Farmer, who has been one of the architects of the civil rights movement in America. In 1943, Farmer co-founded CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality. Their statement of purpose was to eliminate all racial segregation and discrimination by means of nonviolent, direct action. CORE was one of the first groups to apply Gandhi's principles of nonviolent resistance to the civil rights movement. CORE became nationally known in 1961 when it organized the first freedom rides, in which small interracial groups rode on buses through the South to test the Supreme Court decision banning segregation in bus terminals serving interstate passengers. As CORE became more successful, its emphasis shifted from desegregation to political action, economic discrimination, and problems in black communities. Farmer was the national director of CORE from 1961 to 1966. He had formerly served as program director for the NAACP. In 1969, he accepted the position of Assistant Secretary of the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. Under President Nixon, he left 1 year later in frustration. Farmer has since been lecturing and consulting on minority affairs. He recently served as the director of the Coalition of American Public Employees. He's now the chairman of the board of the Fund for an Open Society, which is a nonprofit mortgage fund to further integrated housing. He's been commuting to Philadelphia once a week from his home in Fredericksburg, Virginia. He's presenting a series of seminars on the civil rights movement at the Philadelphia campus of Antioch College, where he's a distinguished professor. He'll be giving this series of seminars on the civil rights movement again next semester, and for more information, you can call Antioch at 629-1370. That's 629-1370. James Farmer is also completing his memoir, Lay Bare the Heart, which will be published in August by Coward McCann. James Farmer, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much, Terry.
At what point did you know that you wanted to be an activist?
I think it was my earliest memory. When I was 3.5 years old, living in Holly Springs, Mississippi, my father was teaching at a small black college, Rust College, there. And my life was pretty sheltered. Any youngster living on a secluded campus in the Deep South, which was pretty much self-contained. I seldom went downtown, and thus I was protected from the worst barbs of segregation and racial hate. But one day, and this, I repeat, was my earliest memory, my mother and I were walking to town. She was going to shop at a store at the town square, and I was a little kid holding on to her finger. It was a hot summer day in hot Mississippi. And after she had finished shopping, we had started home. I said, Mother, I'm thirsty. I want to stop and get a Coke. And then she told me that I could not get a Coke there. Wait until we got home. There was lots of Coke in the icebox. I wanted my Coke now. She said, told you, you can't get a Coke now. Wait till we get home. Well, I said, there's a little boy going into that store across the street, and I bet he's going to get a Coke. And I pulled my mother by the hand across the street, and we looked through closed screen doors to what I think was a drugstore. And this little kid had climbed up on a stool at the counter, and surely enough, he was sipping a soft drink through a straw. I said, see there, Mother? We can get a Coke in there. He got his Coke. Let's go in and get our Coke. And she said, you can't get a Coke in there. Wait till we get home. There's lots of Coke there. Well, why can't we? He says, you just can't. Well, why can he? She said, he's white. He's white, and me? You're colored. Well, then it hit me. Well, that same thing, really, Terry, happened to, in those days, and to some extent today, happens to every black kid living in a segregated society. At some point, he's told that he is different from other people. Well, we walked home silently, and my mother threw herself across the bed and wept, and I walked out on the porch and sat on the steps. I don't remember the thought processes, of course, but I know that I was determined to do something about it.
I believe you studied theology when you were in college, and had you ever planned on entering the clergy?
Well, yes. Actually, in college, at Wiley College in Marshall, Texas, I took a pre-med course first. Excuse me. I'd planned to be a doctor. Majored in chemistry and minored in biology and physics. But in my senior year, I discovered I couldn't stand the sight of blood. that posed an obstacle. So I had to shift my sights and was interested in the social gospel of Walter Rauschenbusch. So I decided to study for the ministry. Of course, I declined ordination after graduating from the School of Religion at Howard.
Why did you do that?
Well, at that time, the church of which I was a member, the Methodist Church, it was the Methodist Episcopal Church North then, was in the process of reuniting with the Methodist Episcopal Church South. They had split during the Civil War. And the unification plan was a segregated plan. There were to be six jurisdictions in the United Church, the United Methodist Church, five of which were geographical. The sixth was not geographical, but racial, so that a black church, whether it was in Maine or Georgia, would be in the central jurisdiction. Well, remember, that was before the emphasis on black identity and black unity. That was a time when we were seeking color blindness. I did not see how I could preach the gospel of Christ in a segregated church, and thus I refused to be ordained.
You were one of the founders of CORE in 1943. Can you describe what it was like at that founding meeting and what the goals were of CORE?
Well, yes, you have to remember, Terry, that this was wartime. Actually, it was in 1942 that we founded CORE, shortly after the Pearl Harbor. Most of the persons who were in the initial group were pacifists, as I was at that time, refusing to participate in any war. Some were socialists, Norman Thomas-type socialists, democratic socialists. As pacifists, we were interested in finding nonviolent solutions to social conflict situations, not only internationally, but domestically. And that naturally led us to Mahatma Gandhi, who had developed a very elaborate and effective nonviolence technique in India in fighting for freedom, first in South Africa and later in India. We began studying Gandhi then, and considered that a lot of promise lay in the Gandhian techniques. So CORE was founded on the basis of a couple of memoranda which I wrote and circulated in early 1942. We called together the first group, largely white, but it was an interracial group. And the organization was to be an interracial organization using Gandhian techniques of nonviolent direct action in a frontal assault upon segregation and racial discrimination.
Did you think that Gandhi's techniques of passive resistance were going to work in the South, where there was a history of brutality towards blacks on the part of white law enforcement officials and the public?
That's a very interesting question. We started in Chicago, you notice, and many people are not aware that in those years, in the early 40s, there was widespread discrimination in places of public accommodation, such as restaurants, theaters, hotels, swimming pools, public beaches, and so on there. And most of the CORE chapters in the first several years of our existence as an organization were in northern cities, north, east, and west, not in the South, certainly not in the Deep South. At every early convention of CORE, they were held annually, we would debate whether to, quote, invade the South, unquote. And this became the strongest debate of the whole session. I felt and argued that that was not the time in the early 40s, that sit-ins throughout the South and stand-ins and civil disobedience would be suicidal, that we would just be slaughtered, and especially the people who lived there, the blacks who lived in those communities, would be slaughtered. I don't know whether we were right or wrong. I suspect that we were right.
But you felt the time was right in the early 60s for that work?
Oh, yes, the time was right in the 50s and 60s. In the 50s, thanks to Martin Luther King, the Montgomery bus boycott, where the technique of nonviolence was seen by Americans on television under charismatic leadership, with masses of people in one city, the seat of the Confederacy, staying off the buses because of segregation, and doing it happily and joyously. The time was certainly right then, but even so, there had to be considerable training in order for it to be effective.
You did some of that training, and Corps did a lot of training of people who were, of the Freedom Riders especially.
Oh, yes.
Well, what kind of training would you have to do for someone who is uninitiated in passive resistance?
Well, a great deal of training. Let me tell you one little anecdote. When we were recruiting for the Freedom Rides, one young black fellow who was a prize fighter, a boxer, an up-and-coming middleweight, wanted to volunteer. I said to him, well, now look, you realize this is a nonviolent movement, and you're a fighter. He said, I know, Mr. Farmer, that's all right. I said, well, now what's going to happen if somebody takes a punch at you, throws a punch at you? He thought that went over for a while. He said, well, Mr. Farmer, it's all right if they throw a punch at me, but just tell them don't ring a bell. So, but now to the training. I think I can answer that question best by illustrating the training during the Freedom Rides, when we called together a group of 13 persons for 1 week training session in preparation for the most dangerous experience of their lives. First, we, of course, had speakers. We had a lawyer come in and talk to us about the legal situation in the South in regard to bus riding, interstate bus travel, and the use of the waiting room facilities. What the Supreme Court had said and what the local state laws and local ordinances said, and what our legal rights were in the event of arrest, which was very likely. Then we had social scientists talk to us about the customs and mores and folkways of the people in those areas through which we'd be going, and the lengths to which the local populace would probably go to maintain their customs. And we had social activists talk to us about what the real situation was and what they thought was really going to happen to us, and they told us we were going to be killed, probably, or would escape narrowly with our lives. Then we engaged in role-playing, sociodramas. For example, we would have about half of the group play the role of freedom riders sitting at a simulated lunch counter asking for coffee or a hot dog. The other half would play the role of hoodlums coming in to beat them up, and they would knock them off the stools at the counter and stomp and kick them, and I must say they were pretty realistic. I thought too much so. But the purpose of that was to make sure we knew how to cover up so as hopefully to prevent serious permanent injury. Then we would go into a discussion of that sociodrama, asking what did the Freedom Riders do that they should not have done in the situation? What should they have done that they failed to do? Then we would reverse roles and have those who played the hoodlums play Freedom Riders and those who played Freedom Riders hoodlums, and discuss that. At the end of that week, I honestly felt that those 13 people, including myself, were prepared for anything, even death. And they thought death was a possibility. I recall when we had our last dinner before leaving Washington to board the buses, we ate at a Chinese restaurant, and somebody commented, it seems something like the Last Supper, doesn't it?
What were the options that Freedom Riders had if they were sitting at a lunch counter and hoodlums came in and assaulted them?
Well, the option was to accept the punishment, accept the beating, and not to respond with violence, not to strike back. We expected that violence, not only in the bus terminals, but also on the buses, where the whites would sit in the back of the buses and the blacks would sit in the front of the buses, which was a violation of the local and state laws, and refused to move when ordered, accepting violence and accepting arrest if it came.
What was the number of people that you thought was appropriate for each group of Freedom Riders?
Well, we started with small groups. We were still thinking in small terms then, Corps was. We were thinking of tightly disciplined, well-trained cadres of activists who would go into that situation and be able to absorb the violence without striking back. So we had six on a Greyhound bus and seven on a Trailways bus, or vice versa. However, the Freedom Ride soon exploded into a mass movement because of the violence that we encountered in Alabama.
What are some of your most vivid memories of those trips?
My most vivid memories are, one, the ride from Montgomery, Alabama, to Jackson, Mississippi, which was almost like a military operation, because by that time, the federal government had gotten involved. Robert Kennedy, who was Attorney General then, had asked me to call off the Freedom Rides and have a cooling-off period, and I had refused to do so, replying that we've been cooling off for 350 years, and if we cool off anymore, we're in a deep freeze, and the rides would go on. Well, he, of course, felt that was a very arrogant response, and he did not appreciate it. However, he did act. He persuaded the governor of Alabama to bring in the National Guard. First, Bobby Kennedy sent U.S. Marshals down and persuaded the governor to bring in the National Guard to keep the peace because whites were rioting after the Freedom Riders' blood, literally, in Montgomery. And when we boarded buses to go to Jackson, there were Alabama National Guardsmen on the bus with us, with rifles and bayonets fixed. There were newspaper reporters, too, because this was the big story of the day. And there were helicopters chopping around overhead, searching the woods and forests through which we'd be going. State police sirens and federal agents' cars were screaming up and down the highway in front of us and behind us. So it was a military operation then. It wasn't the old Freedom Ride type. And we got to the state border between Alabama and Mississippi and were greeted by that sign, "Welcome to the Magnolia State." The Alabama Director of Public Safety came on board. The bus had stopped and whispered to one of the reporters some message and left the bus. That reporter whispered the message to the other reporters. Five of the reporters then left the bus. And I asked the remaining one what the message had been. He said director of public safety said they had been informed from reliable sources that the bus was going to be ambushed and destroyed inside the Mississippi border. So it was a hairy ride. The ambush did not come. When we passed the area at which they probably expected the ambush to develop, there were Mississippi National Guardsmen flanking the highway with their guns pointed toward the woods, the dense forests on both sides. And I overheard an officer of the guard shout, "Look behind every tree." So apparently that's where they expected the Klan, I suppose, to attack. Then the most memorable experience, O'Terry, was in the jails itself. The new thing, the new element that the Freedom Rides added to the civil rights movement was staying in jail, following Gandhi's principle of filling up the jails to place as heavy a burden as possible on the offending authority. And so we decided to stay in rather than bailing out right away. We had year-and-a-day sentences. The maximum we could stay in and still appeal, and all of us wanted to appeal, was 40 days. So we determined that we were going to stay in 40 days. Furthermore, I instructed my office to recruit Freedom Riders and send them in on every bus possible so that the numbers built up and we literally filled up the jails of Mississippi.
What was the response of the law enforcement officials?
Well, Mississippi didn't know how to deal with this, and we were succeeding in placing heavy burden on them. It was announced in a local paper that one of the nuisance taxes that they had, auto use tax or something like that, which they had planned to repeal or to eliminate, could not be eliminated because the Freedom Rides were costing the state so much money. What they had to do was to beef up their police force. and lots of overtime, hire more policemen. They had to hire more members, more officers of what they call the Mississippi Bureau of Investigation, their state FBI. And they fanned them out all over the country to look into the background of every individual freedom rider trying to find derogatory information, hoping to come up with the fact that they were communists or that they were dope users or something like that to discredit the freedom rides. And furthermore, we sent so many in, we filled up the city jail, the county jail, the county farm. The city of Jackson then rented the whole maximum security unit at the state penitentiary at Parchman. That was costing them a lot of money to put us in. Their response was, why did you come here? You know, we didn't tell you to come. We didn't ask you to come. Now, since you're here, we want you to stay here and rot. We asked to go out and work because we wanted sunlight and fresh air. No, we're not going to let you do that, they said. You stay here and rot. We have to feed you, but we don't have to make the food so you can eat it. You can fill it so full of salt that you won't be able to eat it. And they tried that for about a week or so, and, well, I lost some weight, which was good.
So the being in prison actually hurt the states financially.
It hurt them. But then the state determined that it was going to try, decided it was going to try to put CORE out of business, and it almost did.
How did it try to do that?
By the bond requirements, bail bond requirements. First, it was $500 each, and we had over 350 freedom riders in at one time. $500 each, and had to be cash bond. We couldn't get a company, a bail bonding company. Then when we went on appeal, they tripled the bond. $1,500 cash. Well, I, as National Director of CORE, tried hard to find a company that would put up the money. Bail bonding company. Thought I had a company in Hartford. They called us in a couple of days and said they would have to cancel the agreement with us because the state of Mississippi had informed them that if they wrote bond for even one freedom rider, they would lose a license to operate in the state of Mississippi. So we had to raise that cash. And the attorney for Jackson told our lawyer that they decided that if they could knock CORE out of the box, they had broken the back of the so-called freedom, so-called civil rights movement in the state of Mississippi, and that's what they were going to try to do. And they almost succeeded.
When there were people from the North who were coming down to participate in the freedom rides, do you think that they were able to easily understand what was happening in the South, since the North and the South were pretty different cultures?
Oh, I think, yes, because a large number, a large percentage of those who came down were students, white students, too. So they had some familiarity with the race problem, the race situation in the South. And incidentally, the law enforcement officials and the correctional officials in the jails often said they could understand the colored people doing this, meaning the blacks. And if they were black, they'd probably do the same thing, but they couldn't understand those white people coming down there. They said, what are they coming down here for? We don't discriminate against them. They could not understand the kind of compassion, the kind of humaneness that would drive people to risk their lives on behalf of other people.
James Farmer is my guest, if you're just joining us, and he was one of the founders of CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, in 1942, and served as its director from 1961 to 1966. There were times when people really knew that they were risking their lives to continue on the freedom rides or to participate in demonstrations. What advice were you able to give about how individuals could judge for themselves whether they should really participate, whether they were really willing to make that risk?
Well, they had to ask themselves that question when the time came. As I told the Freedom Riders just before we left Washington to board the buses, I said, there's still time to go back home. You don't have to do this. We know you said you would, but you know now what the risks are. Go back home and no one is going to blame you. We're not going to badmouth you. If you don't think you can take it, if you would rather not, then just pack up and go now. Nobody left. We had many things going for us then. One was peer pressure. You know, if you're alone, it's difficult to do lots of things, but if there are others with you who are risking the same thing you are risking, then it's possible to do many things.
You were going to be a doctor and decided not to because you didn't like the sight of blood, and here you were in demonstrations in which people were going to get bloodied,
yes.
And you were risking your physical well-being.
That's the irony of it. I did not go into medicine because I couldn't stand the sight of blood, and since then I've seen more blood than I would have imagined.
Did you learn how to cope with it?
Yes, I learned how to cope with it. It was for a cause, and that's a little bit different than having people come in wounded and just seeing useless blood there.
We're in the period of the anniversary of John Kennedy's assassination, and there are many biographies and reappraisals mm-hmm. being published and filmed now, network documentaries. Looking back, what do you think of John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy and their commitment in the 60s to civil rights?
A very interesting question, Terry. Contrary to the public view, the popular view, at the outset of JFK's presidency, neither he nor his brother had a strong commitment to civil rights, in my judgment. Both were opposed to new civil rights legislation and told us so when the heads of civil rights organizations, Dr. King, Roy Wilkins, Whitney Young, John Lewis of SNCC, and I, of CORE, met with him. They said they did not think new civil rights legislation was either feasible or desirable. No, feasible or necessary. That was the word that they used. And they were making political judgments then. They were not had no real knowledge of the plight of blacks. It was even said during the campaign of 1960, Jackie Robinson, the late baseball player, told me that John F. Kennedy said to him during the campaign, "Well, Mr. Robinson, I don't know any Negroes. Can you introduce me to some?" Because he had grown up in a different kind of world, you see, and gone to exclusive schools, and had had no contact with blacks except maybe a few who worked for them as domestics then. So it was understandable. But John F. Kennedy and his brother both grew in that administration and came to feel it quite deeply. We had to pressure them and prod them, of course. I remember during the campaign of 1960, Jack Kennedy said that there was one area of discrimination that the president could wipe out with a stroke of the pen, and Eisenhower should have done it but did not. When he was elected, he would issue an executive order which would outlaw segregation in certain forms of housing, public housing. Well, after he got elected, we waited months for that stroke of the pen. It didn't come. So the National Committee Against Discrimination in Housing started a campaign of Ink for Jack, and we mailed many bottles of ink to the White House. Then the stroke of the pen came, and we got the executive order. On the Freedom Rides, Robert Kennedy, Bobby, as I said, asked me to call it off, and I refused to do so. But we prodded them, and they responded to the pressure, and they acted. You might say we tilted at windmills, and then the Kennedys would step in and bowl them over for us.
So all in all, you think that they did all right, but they needed a lot of pressuring to do it.
Yes. We had to try to teach them, I guess, and if that doesn't sound too arrogant, but everyone needs teaching if they're not familiar with the situation. And they learned.
James Farmer is my guest, and he was the national director of CORE from 1961 through 66. He co-founded CORE in 1942. He's currently a distinguished professor at Antioch College, in which he's giving a series of seminars on the civil rights movement, and this series will be repeated next semester. How close were you to Martin Luther King?
We worked closely together on many, many occasions. There was a meeting of what was generally called the Big Four. Actually, it should have been the Big Six. The four were Dr. King, Roy Wilkins, Whitney Young, and me. But also there were John Lewis of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and he's frequently left out of that because he was a student then. And then there was Dorothy Height, who is was and is president of the National Council of Negro Women. She's left out of that configuration very often because of sexism in society. So the press called it the Big Four. It was the Big Six. Well, we met about monthly in New York from 1961 until the end of 1963 to plan strategy, map strategy, to compare notes, to share experiences, and to divide the turf, so to speak, so that we wouldn't be competing in the same areas. Certain states were designated as core states, others as SNCC states, others as SCLC states, and so on.
SNCC was one of the groups that, after a while, started to think that it was no longer appropriate for white people to be working in the civil rights movement, that blacks should be doing it themselves, and that it was getting to the point where it would be patronizing for whites to work further. Did you agree with that?
No. I did not agree with it. I could understand their argument. It developed out of the great freedom summer of 1964, when CORE and SNCC combined in Mississippi into an organization called COFO, Council of Federated Organizations. And the two organizations were SNCC and CORE. We were working that state together. And COFO called for a mass of college students and others to volunteer to come to Mississippi to saturate the state with voter registration efforts and voter education efforts. We got thousands of volunteers, students saying, send me, I'll go. They were not going to be paid a cent, and they were going to be living without a tomorrow. And when they'd leave home in the morning, not knowing whether they'd return that night, living with a poor black family in rural Mississippi. And it was going to be very, very rough indeed. And that's, by the way, the summer where Mickey Schwerner, Andy Goodman, and Jim Chaney, who were CORE staff members, were killed. So at this time, when these students came down, full of enthusiasm and zest, they did a terrific job. But they were much better educated, much more sophisticated, than most of the blacks who were in the movement, active in the movement. As such, they began to get the best positions. They did the clean work in many, many cases. They ran things very, very often, and much resentment built up as a result of that. Now, I'm oversimplifying because there were many other aspects of it, but that did come about. It is true that there was much paternalism in the interracial or civil rights organizations at that time. That's a hard thing to get rid of. We worked at it. I disagreed with SNCC's putting the whites out. CORE did not put them out. My successor, Floyd McKissick, who was a fine person, and I had supported him for the position after I resigned, did not put whites out at all. Many whites left because they began to feel uncomfortable as the Black Power movement spread, and they just didn't feel wanted. But no one told them to leave in CORE.
Another development was that Malcolm X started to challenge the usefulness of passive resistance and thought that there should be a stronger response than just turning the other cheek to the violence that America was using against blacks. How did you feel about Malcolm X's stand on black organization?
Well, Malcolm and I had quite a few debates. We had, I think, five debates, one at Cornell University, huge audience, and others on radio and television. So we disagreed. He was taking the separationist point of view, and I was taking the integrationist position. He called it not segregation, but separation, which was a voluntary thing rather than a forced thing. He was a very strong proponent of it and a very effective one. Malcolm came to change. He began to change later. The last year of his life, after he had been expelled from the Muslims, the Nation of Islam, he'd been expelled because of some statement he made about Kennedy after the assassination. He said, the chickens have come home to roost. I don't know what he meant by that, but at any rate, Elijah Muhammad put him out temporarily, and then a year later made it permanent. Malcolm began to travel around the world. He'd been a narrow man because he had not traveled, and he was self-educated. He had no formal education, elementary school, that's all. I got postcards from him, various stops on his round-the-world trips. I got two from Mecca at different times. The first one said, Dear Brother James, here I am in this most beautiful and sacred city where I have witnessed pilgrims of all colors, and he underscored those words, worshiping Allah in perfect peace and harmony and brotherhood such as I've never seen in the States. Then, some weeks later, a card from Mecca saying, Dear Brother James, here I am back in Mecca. I am still traveling, trying to broaden my mind, because I have seen so much of the damage that narrow-mindedness can make of things. When I return to the States, I plan to devote my energies to repairing that damage. Very interesting cards from Malcolm. I later asked him what they meant, and he told me. He was at my home. This was Christmas Eve, 64. That's 2 months before he was killed. And I asked him if those postcards had indicated a change in his thinking. And I told him what the cards had said, refreshed his memory. He said, yes. He says, I was not lucky, as you were, Brother James. I didn't have much formal education. And naturally, I believed everything that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad had told us. And he told us that Islam was a religion for black men, black people, and that whites couldn't get close to Mecca, they'd be killed. And there I saw blue-eyed blondes worshiping Allah with me, and I knew that Elijah Muhammad had lied. And I had to do some rethinking, and I asked him where his rethinking had led him. He said, to tell you the truth, I have concluded that anyone who will fight along with us, not for us, but along with us, is my brother. And that goes for your three guys, too, Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney.
You think had he lived longer that there would have been a shift in his politics?
Yes, there would have been. I asked him also in that conversation why he had not said that, the change in his thinking, at the rally which he had held the previous Saturday at Harlem Square, 125th Street and Lenox Avenue. And his reply was, if a leader makes a sudden right-angle turn, he turns alone.
Right. What dynamic did it set up in the civil rights movement to have, on the one hand, the more militant end of it, led maybe by Malcolm X and others, and the civil disobedience? Because you had two different levels that the black movement was operating on. Do you think that the militancy, and then the militancy of the Panthers, too, who succeeded in that movement, created... two different alternatives for the white establishment, you know?
You have
the passive resistance, and if you don't meet that, well,
all right,
there's
something
more militant around the corner waiting
right
for you.
Gandhi faced that, too. And Gandhi, though he was a thoroughgoing pacifist himself, he winked at the violent people, the Sikhs and others in India, because he knew they helped him in a way, helped his movement. The same thing was true with us. Now, I was sort of in the middle between, say, Whitney Young of the Urban League and Malcolm X of the Muslims. Now, Whitney used that. Whitney Young would be talking with corporation heads about employing blacks. What he would say is, look, if you don't do what I'm telling you to do, Jim Farmer and Core will get you. And that would work. Well, we could do the same thing with Malcolm. You know, Malcolm X will get you. And it worked. So it was useful having Malcolm X around.
James Farmer is my guest if you're just joining us. And he was a founder of CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, in 1942, and was the national director of the group from 1961 to 1966. Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, Medgar Evers, were assassinated. Did you ever fear for your life as one of the country's leading civil rights activists?
Yes, constantly. Maybe fear is not the word there. I don't mean to say that we had no fear. We were afraid all the time. I was running scared most of the time, you know, in the demonstrations in Louisiana when the Klan had met and decided I was to be killed. On another occasion when I had to get out of Plaquemine, Louisiana, in the back of a hearse to escape from lynch mob. So we were scared, too. But it was not death itself that we were afraid of, because we knew that death might come at any time. Dr. King once told me that he knew he was going to be killed. This was not long before he was assassinated. Says that the thing that bothered him most was he didn't know whether his assassin was going to be white or black, because in those days the militant blacks hated Dr. King, too, and were threatening his life. I was receiving threats. The thing that bothered me most was when they threatened my family, my late wife and my two little girls. They'd call up and tell my wife, "We're going to kill your two little girls." And, you know, that bothered me. I did not want those kids to suffer. And then took precautions to see that they did not suffer. But as far as protecting myself, I knew that if they really wanted to get me, they could get me. They got Kennedy. They got King. They willing to use eye-powered rifle with telescopic sights, they can get you. And certainly if they're willing to swap a life for a life, they can get you.
Did you have a bodyguard?
No, I did not have bodyguards. I did get some CORE people and some city police to surround the building in which I was living in New York at the time they threatened my children. But I didn't travel with bodyguards at all. One occasion, I think the FBI saved my life. I know they did. When they informed me that the Klan had met in Bogalusa, Louisiana, the previous day, and decided that I was to be killed next time I went down there, and said, "When are you going next? Let us know." "I'm going tomorrow." "And at what airline, what flight, what time?" When I got there, the pilot announced over the PA system that deplaning passengers for New Orleans, deplane now except for Farmer, he'd keep his seat. Then plainclothes detectives came on from the state police. That their governor had been told that my life was in danger. He had gotten a call from Washington, and he had called the head of the state police, and the head of the state police had assigned four plainclothes detectives as my personal bodyguards. And they did save my life.
And this was in Louisiana?
This was in Louisiana.
Well, they were cooperative?
Hmm?
The state police were cooperative?
Oh, at times. It depended upon what orders they got. 1 year earlier, in 1964, it was the state police who had tried to kill me. They were rampaging in a mob in Plaquemine, Louisiana, with a lot of deputized rednecks, as the local people from the country, the rural area, with guns, tear gas, electric cattle prods, and clubs, and horses to ride. And they were screaming, "Come on out, Farmer. When we catch that so-and-so, we're going to kill him." And those were state police and deputies. But it was a year later that the state police, there was a different governor then, and they had different orders, saved my life.
Well, you must have been pretty confused not knowing what to expect from them. 1 year they save your life, and the other year they're trying to kill you.
Yes, but I did know. They were professionals, and they'd follow whatever orders they got to the best of their ability.
What do you think now are the times and the incidents that civil disobedience is most effective in? And for what things does it not work, do you think?
Well, that's a very difficult question, but a good one. We used classic civil disobedience, disobeying laws which we believed to be bad. We didn't consider the Freedom Rides, by the way, to be civil disobedience, because though we were disobeying state and local laws in the South, We were obeying the federal law, the Constitution, as interpreted by the Supreme Court. So that was not civil disobedience. But we would disobey a law if we considered the law to be bad. That was classic civil disobedience. And my feeling was that you have not only a right, but a duty to do that. I followed Henry David Thoreau on that. He said, most of all, I must see to it that I do not lend myself to the evil which I condemn. Now, there was another time we practiced, another kind of time we practiced civil disobedience. For example, in the opening day of the World's Fair in New York, 1964, June, I sat down with a number of other people in front of the doorway going into the New York City Pavilion and blocked entrance to it. Now, I believe in laws against blocking entrances. Those are not bad laws. They're good laws. We were violating a good law there in order to bring the spotlight of public attention upon other evils. Kind of a Socratic gadfly, I would say. It was discrimination in employment, discrimination in housing in New York. Nobody was going to be killed by our blocking entrance. If there were a fire and there were people inside, they could get out, or we'd get out of the way then. No one was going to be hurt. So we courted arrest in order to get people to look at other issues. So I think civil disobedience can serve useful functions if it's carried out nonviolently and if the people who practice it are willing to accept arrest. Because Gandhi insisted on arrest. He said, I'm a lawyer. I believe in law and order. I have deliberately broken your law. It is your duty to arrest me. You must arrest me.
Is there a point where you think that passive resistance doesn't work in a fight?
Oh, yes. I'm not a pacifist anymore. And I certainly do not believe that nonviolence can solve all problems. Nor do I believe that violence solves no problems. It does solve some problems. There are times when I would go to war now. For example, I would want to volunteer if they'll take an old, almost blind man in South Africa.
I guess that's an example of a place where if you were doing passive resistance, you'd probably get killed. It wouldn't change the government.
That's right. You see, the British imprisoned Gandhi. And he fasted. Hitler would have shot him. The South Africans would have had him found hanged in his own cell and told the world that he committed suicide.
In America now, the racism and discrimination aren't as clear-cut as they were in the times of formal segregation. What kinds of techniques do you think work now where it's just a little more difficult to measure and to document specifically the ways of racism and discrimination?
Hmm. Good question. And I wish I could give a simple answer. I wish I knew a simple answer, but I don't. First of all, we have to dramatize even these complex issues that we face, and they can be dramatized. The evils of poverty that still exist in the ghettos and barrios of our country can be dramatized with photography, with pictures. We haven't done enough of that. The problem of a diet and poor nutrition for pregnant mothers and the effect that it has upon the children, that, too, can be dramatized. And the effect of intervention by food supplements, the before and after. We can do much more with more imagination.
One last question. Today is election day. Do you think that electoral politics have been effective in ending, in lessening discrimination?
Oh, yes. I think that we are reaping the benefits of the massive voter registration drives that the civil rights organizations put on in the early 1960s in the South, where we registered about half of, more than half of the potential there. and now we have more than 5,000 black elected officials, whereas before that drive we had 50, maybe. So, electoral action has been very beneficial, and I hope it will continue and become more sophisticated.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us today. It's really been interesting. Thanks a lot for being here.
Thank you, Terry.
James Farmer has been my guest, and he helped to found CORE in 1942. That's the Congress of Racial Equality. From 1961 to 66, he served as its national director. He is now writing his autobiography, which is scheduled to be published in August. It will be called Lay Bare the Heart, the autobiography of James Farmer, and the publisher is Coward McCann. He's also teaching a series of seminars now at Antioch College at their Philadelphia campus, where he's a distinguished professor. And this series will be repeated next semester. For more information, you can call Antioch at 629-1370. That's 629-1370. James Farmer has been commuting to Philadelphia to teach these seminars from his home near Fredericksburg, Virginia. Thank you again for talking with us.
Thank you.